Those scriptures were Isaiah chapter 40. That's where we are this morning. You'll find a sermon outline in the back of your bulletin. We make the leap from the first 39 chapters of Isaiah, which is all one thing, all one section, to the second section, chapter 40. But here's the link between the two. Isaiah was a prophet during the reign of four different kings, and the fourth king was Hezekiah. We saw the details of what happened under his prophesying, under Hezekiah's reign last week. Saw that at a point in his life, Hezekiah was a terrific king and a man of great faith. And though there was a huge enemy coming up against his people, the Assyrian Empire, Hezekiah led the way and set an example of faith that trusted the Lord and called people to trust in the Lord. With him as only an arm of strength, with us as the Lord our God, he said. And as a result, the Assyrian Empire was destroyed, 185,000 soldiers dead all at once by an act of God. And the nation was wonderfully delivered. Well, Hezekiah lived on 15 years longer than he first was predicted to live, as you remember the story. And the last years of his life were tragic because the great thing about him, his faith, began to fade. And we saw that in chapter 39. When he was sent a very flattering letter and a very appreciated gift from the new up-and-coming emperor of the new up-and-coming empire, the Babylonian Empire, he kind of went all to pieces. And instead of doing what he should have done by faith, he did the natural thing. He courted the favor of this up-and-coming world leader. He brought him into Jerusalem. He showed him his stuff. He showed him the treasuries. He showed him all the fabulous riches. And this was the wrong thing to do. And Isaiah had come to Hezekiah and said to him in chapter 39, verse 6, "Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day shall be carried to Babylon. Nothing shall be left, says the Lord. And some of your sons who shall issue from you, whom you shall beget, shall be taken away, and they shall become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon." And understand the mindset of the Hebrew people who understood that they were the chosen people of God. The idea that his sons growing up would be carted away into Babylon and would become important in a pagan empire should have struck him as a nightmarish possibility, but it didn't. He was okay with it. All he saw was that it wouldn't show up. The consequences of his misconduct wouldn't show up in his own life, and that was fine with him. But it clearly wasn't fine with Isaiah and should not have been fine with Hezekiah. And Isaiah comes next in what starts the second section of Isaiah, chapters 40 to 66, with words from God. And remarkably, the words are words of comfort. Isaiah had predicted a terrible thing that was going to happen as a consequence in the future. But before it happened, and before the people began to taste the bitter reality of it, there were already words of comfort from God. And this is what we have in chapter 40 today. And what we have in chapter 40 then is a detailed explanation of the sort of comfort that God stands by ready to give people who call upon him. So maybe you're a person who needs some comfort. Hezekiah wasn't, because what was coming down the road in his experience was going to come after he had passed away. It would come to his children. But whether you're in the difficulty now or are about to be in the difficulty, and who could predict that without a prophet like Isaiah on hand to explain? Here is the comfort of God. Here is what God says. Here is how God comforts people who are in distress. This will be food for the souls of any of you who are in distress right now. And I hope if you're not, you'll store it away, because who knows what the future holds. But here's the comfort that God will offer you. How does God comfort his people then? That's the question. And the text, Isaiah chapter 40, gives us the answer. We start off with two verses. "Comfort, oh, comfort my people, says your God. Speak kindly to Jerusalem and call out to her that her warfare has ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she's received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins." Long before there was anything to be comforted about, here was the comfort offered. And notice what kind of comfort it is. How does God comfort his people? In the first place, he offers them forgiveness for their sins. He says, her warfare has ended. The warfare hadn't even started when Isaiah said it, but this was God speaking for the future. Her warfare has ended. Her iniquity has been removed. God, in the first place, comforts his people, comforts us who are his people, by offering forgiveness of sins. And that may not be the comfort we're looking for, but it's the comfort that God says we must start with. And this order of things reminds me of a real-life story I know. I'll tell you now about a young woman who years ago came to a pastor she hardly knew for advice. And I'm not being subtle. I am not that pastor. It's a man I know. And as far as I know, none of you know the lady. So I'm not talking about somebody in the church family or somebody that you could attach the details to. But she went to this man who she understood to be a godly man, and she was right about that, because very recently, to her great horror, her husband had left her for another woman, left her with a young child to raise on her own. So she went to this godly man, and she said what any woman would say in the situation. She said, "What can you tell me to do? How can you help me? What can you show me needs to happen to get my husband back? Give me some stuff to do, or some prayers to pray, or some help to get my husband back." And this godly man said very wisely, "I have nothing to offer you under that heading." He was like Peter the apostle when the cripple said, "Give me silver or gold." And the apostle said, "Silver or gold have I none, but what I have I give to you. And here's what I have to give you." And Peter healed that man. Well, the pastor said, I can't tell you anything that will guarantee that your husband comes back. But what I can give you is some ideas on how you could get right with God." And she said years later that the words came to her like a bucket of cold water over her head. It's like a slap in the face. She didn't come to be criticized religiously. She came for religious help. But this is the order of things. And he was right to say to her, if you want anything from God at all, and there aren't guarantees about happy endings in this world, but if you want anything from God at all, you got to get right with God. And what keeps you from getting right with God is this whole mess of life brought about by the difficulty we normally have obeying God. You've got some sins that need to be forgiven. This is what God offers his people. The comfort that God offers us is eternal comfort, comfort in regard to the eternal aspects of our lives. So the first thing God does for us as we come to him for any kind of help is give us the help we need the most, which is the forgiveness of sins. And so that's what we need to look for from God. God comforts his people by offering them forgiveness of sins. And then what does he do? After that, we'll read on, verse 3 to 8. A voice is calling, "Clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. And let the rough ground become a plain, and the rugged terrain a broad valley. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken." A voice says, "Call out." Then he answered, "What shall I call out?" And here's the answer. "All flesh is grass, and all its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever." How does God comfort his people? First things first, he offers them the forgiveness of sins. If we will go to God in Jesus' name and confess our sins, that is, agree with God that what he calls sin is in fact sin, what he calls disobeying is in fact disobeying, he will forgive us for all of that. And then what does he do? What's the second thing he does? Well, there's all this business about hills being flattened and valleys being filled up. And what's all that about? Listen, the idea, very common in some scholarly circles, that there are two Isaiahs because chapters 40 to 66 is so different from chapters 1 to 39, is an opinion that should be seriously called into question, because what we see from chapters 40 to 66 has all been said before in various ways. And this has been said before in chapter 35. Chapter 35, verse 2, predicted that one day they will see the glory of the Lord, the majesty of our God. Isaiah had said in verse 3, "Encourage the exhausted, strengthen the feeble, say to those with anxious heart, take courage, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. And the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped." And verse 8, "And a highway will be there, a roadway, and it will be called the highway of holiness." Why are the mountains flattened? Why are the valleys filled in? Because God means to build a highway. What's the highway for? It's a highway of holiness. Guess. What's it for? It's for people to get to God. Verse 10 says, "The ransomed of the Lord will return, and they'll come with joyful shouting to Zion. With everlasting joy upon their heads, they'll find gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing will flee away." How does God comfort his people? In the first place, he offers them forgiveness of sins. And in the second place, he offers them a relationship with himself. He makes it possible for them to get close to him. He offers them a relationship to himself. So we have the words, "Here is your God, and your God will come." And this figure of speech, this highway will be built. Not that we suffer from difficulties getting to God geographically, but we suffer from difficulties in getting to God, and all those difficulties will be resolved. God offers us the opportunity for a relationship with Himself. And these very words in Isaiah chapter 40 are quoted in Matthew and Mark in the Gospels to explain the work of John the Baptist. He was the voice crying in the wilderness. He was the one who said, "Prepare the way of the Lord." He was the one who was getting the world in his day ready for Jesus, because Jesus coming to the world was ultimately the making of the highway of holiness. It's Jesus coming into the world that made it possible for people to come to God. Okay? So how does God comfort his people? In the second place, he offers them a relationship to himself. He makes a highway so that we can get to God, and that's the comfort. So we sometimes don't think to go to God until we have a problem. And we come to God and we say, "Now I got a problem, now I need God." And we do need God. But we don't always get a snappy solution to our problem. Who knows? Maybe the snappy solution to our problem will cause us to lose all interest in God. We'll say, "Hey, that was great. Next time I have a problem, I'm coming back to God." The lady who went to the pastor and asked for help in getting her husband back has been without her husband now, must be 20 years. Husband never came back. She raised her little boy as a single mom. But she is a strong woman of God. She has developed a ministry which in some ways, not to overstate it, is kind of worldwide. And her son has grown up to be a strong young man of God. She looks back on that disaster in her life, her husband abandoning her, as the wake-up call from God to get serious about the thing for which she was created. Not to say that it's a good idea. Not to say that he was in any way excused. His leaving his wife was all to do with his worldliness and his faithlessness and his lust and who knows what else. And there's a story being told by his life, but never mind him. Think about her. And him leaving her was the call of God upon her life for the life that God was calling her to live. He offered her the forgiveness of sins. He has offered her a relationship with himself, and her relationship with God is a beautiful thing. So then what does God do? When he offers us himself, he offers us a relationship with him, then what does he do? Well, we have it in the next verse. Verse 9. "Get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news." This he says after having all the mountains flattened and all the valleys filled in. "Then go find yourself a mountain. Get yourself up on a high mountain, O Zion, bearer of good news. Lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up. Do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God." Jerusalem, the city of God, is a way of talking about the people of God, since the significant thing about the city, which makes it of God, is the people of God in it. Zion is the center of the city, sort of the downtown core. And so the prophet is saying, "Now, you people of God, now, Jerusalem, find yourself a prominent spot, stand in the prominent spot, lift up your voice, don't hold back, and shout as loudly as you can to the neighboring cities of Judah, behold," say this, "say, here is your God." So what's all this about? Well, this is an answer to the question of what God does for us after he comforts us. He offers us forgiveness. He offers us a relationship with himself. And then what does he do? He calls the people who really know him. He calls the people who really know him to show him off to the world, to stand in a high place and say, "Here is your God. This is God." And here's where the history helps us to understand the prophecy. When Hezekiah attracted the attention of the king of Babylon, and the king of Babylon wrote him a nice letter, sent him a nice gift, he went all to pieces. He got all woozy. He called the king of Babylon into Jerusalem, and he showed him the treasuries, showed him all the golden goblets. Look, real gold, not just plate, solid gold. Showed him all the worship utensils. Look at those tongs. They're gold, too. Showed him all the stuff. And God is saying, that was wrong. That was wrong-headed. What the king of God's people should have said when the king of Babylon said, "Hey, you guys have something going," what the king of Jerusalem should have said is, "Let me tell you, let me show you my God." And Isaiah was saying on God's behalf, if you insist on pointing out your stuff, well, you're going to lose your stuff. All that stuff gets carried away to Babylon. And the point would be, if Hezekiah had been on the ball, if he had been a man of faith, if he had said to the king of Babylon, "Let me tell you about my God," then the king of Babylon would not have gone back with stuff eventually, but would have gone back with what lasts forever, with the word of God. from the knowledge of God in Jerusalem would have come the knowledge of God in Babylon, and who knows what would have happened to the world next. God calls the people, like us, I think, who really know him, to show him off to the world, unlike what Hezekiah did. And there are many ways for us to do that. Some big and momentous, and some part of the ordinary, and some part of the incidental. Next Sunday night's Christmas comedy, in a lighthearted way, is a chance to say, let me show you something about my God. Let me show you something about the people here. Let me show you my God. And it's just one of, you know, many instances we have to do what we're called to do as the people who know God, to really show him off. But of course, if we're going to show God off, if we're going to talk about God, behold, this is God, we need to know this God. So I'm happy to say that the rest of chapter 40 is sort of an instructional guide to some details about God, which we need to store up in our minds and feast our hearts upon, so that when we have the opportunity to say what we're called to say, when we have the chance to say, let me tell you a bit about God, we've got a bit to say. And here's more than a bit in Isaiah chapter 40, starting in verse 10. Behold, the Lord God will come with might, with his arm ruling for him. Behold, his reward is with him and his recompense before him. Like a shepherd, he'll tend his flock. In his arm, he'll gather the lambs and carry them in his bosom. He'll gently lead the nursing ewes. Take that from any number of angles, and I'm sure what you'll see with me here is that in the first place, Isaiah says, God is great in love. His shepherding is an expression of his love. Even the references to ruling in verse 10 is a reference to his love. Some of the strongest statements about God's ruling in the Old Testament, the Psalms that talk about him ruling with a rod of iron, use in the Hebrew the word translated rule, which is really the word for shepherd. That is, rule like a shepherd. And the rod of iron with which he rules is a shepherd's rod. Well, the shepherding of God is the love of God. His making of a highway of holiness is his love. His offer of forgiveness is his love. His offer of relationship is his love. Think about it. I mean, the forgiveness of sins is a great gift from God, but it's greater when we consider that it comes to us from the very one that we've offended. I mean, it's one thing for someone to come along and say, I see you're in a mess with that person. Let me straighten out the mess for you. But when you're in a mess with that person because you've offended that person, and that person says, I want to straighten this mess out. I want to forgive you for all of that. I want a terrific close relationship with you. Well, that's love. That's the love that God has shown. And he makes this highway, that is, he throws down the mountains and he fills in the valleys and he helps us get close to him in his love for us. And if that's not enough, then like a shepherd with a lamb that's not very good at getting home, he picks us up and he carries us like a shepherd would carry a lamb. And he leads us like a shepherd would lead a nursing ewe. That's his love for us. He's great. He's great in love. We must never forget that. If someone draws us into a conversation about God, or we're able to draw that person in, and we say, God is a great, great God. Maybe we should make it as the first point here. It's the first point in Isaiah. He's great in love. His love is just unbelievable. He offers us forgiveness. He offers us relationship. He makes it possible for us to get into relationship. He leads us. He carries us like a shepherd. He's like a shepherd. We won't want, lack anything. He leads us. He guides us. He anoints our head with oil. The scriptures are full of details about his great, great love. But there's more here, so let's go on. Let me skip verse 12, not because I don't like it, but because I like it so much, I'll save it. And let's look at verses 13 and 14. Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord? Or as his counselor has informed him, with whom did he consult, and who gave him understanding? Who taught him in the path of justice and taught him knowledge and informed him of the way of understanding? These, of course, are rhetorical questions. The obvious answer is no one. The point is, good news. The God who loves us so much does not need a director. Don't bother to apply for the position. The position does not exist. He does not need a counselor. He's not looking for a consultant. He doesn't need a teacher or an informant. He has all the knowledge in the world. He knows everything about everything. And he's more than just knowledgeable. He's wise. He knows what to do with the knowledge. So that's the deal. Besides being great in love, he's great in wisdom. And that's a great combination. You've got this God who really, really, really loves you, wants to do good things for you. He's got good plans for you. But he's really, really, really wise. So he's not going to muff up here. He's not going to inadvertently, in his love, give you something that actually doesn't do you much good. He's too wise for that. I mean, some of us have that experience. Perhaps you're your parents, perhaps your friend, perhaps your boss meant well, did something for you out of genuine loving kindness and messed up your life. That could happen. But it won't happen with God, because his great love is matched by his great wisdom, and he knows what to do with everything he knows. He knows how to show his love. He's great in love, and he's great in wisdom. And that's what we see there. Now let's go back to verse 12, and then they'll move on. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, all the waters, how much, all the waters of the ocean in the hollow of his hand. That's how he measures them. And he's marked off the heavens by the span. That means he shows up in the universe and he goes, how big is the universe? It's that big. He marks off the heavens by the span. And he calculates the dust of the earth by the measure. And he weighs the mountains. There's the Himalayas. There's the Rockies. There's the Colorados. There's the Andes. He puts them in a scale. You could say that this is a statement about his power. And it is. But I'm learning not to say that. Because there's power in his love, there's power in his wisdom, and there's power in this as well. But the power here is shown in his justice. Verse 12 is all about judging. It's all about measuring. It's all about calculating. He measures the oceans. He calculates the dust. He weighs the mountains. He's measuring. He's judging. He's assessing. He's great at that. He's great in justice, absolutely able to judge what is actually true. And interestingly, as he does, he comes to a clear assessment about what's going on in the world today. And we see it in verses 15, 16, and 17. Behold, the nations. Think of the nations. There was the Assyrian Empire, a collaboration of nations. There was the Babylonian Empire. Later, there'd be the Roman Empire. In our days, there's the superpowers of the United States and Communist China and the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union's not there anymore. And here's what we've got, verse 15. Behold, the nations are like a drop from a bucket and are regarded as a speck of dust on the scales. Behold, he lifts up the islands or the coastlands, or I think it should be the continents, like fine dust. Even Lebanon's not enough to burn, nor its beasts enough for a burnt offering. All the nations are as nothing before him. In fact, they are regarded by him as less than nothing. And less than that, they're meaningless. God has a scale. God has an ability to assess. He assesses the nations of the world. This is significant in its time because the nations were the problem. Babylon was going to be the problem. This great superpower was going to be the principal threat. God takes the superpower, puts it in the scale, weighs it. He says, actually, it doesn't weigh anything. Actually, less than anything. It's nothing. It's meaningless. So from God's perspective, Jerusalem has no problems because they just have this Babylonian empire carting away all their treasures, but it's nothing. It's less than nothing. It's meaningless. God in his justice will render it meaningless. Verse 23 will say, he it is who reduces rulers to nothing and makes the judges of the earth meaningless. God, our God, is great in justice. He's completely able to grasp everything. He sizes it all up. He measures it. And compared to him, it's all nothing. Except where he makes it something, it is nothing. That's what's true of the whole world. That's what's true of God. And then he asks a question, Isaiah does in verse 18, and it brings us to our final aspect of God's greatness this morning. Verse 18, the question, to whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare with him? Our fourth point, here is your God, great in love, great in wisdom, great in justice, entirely unique. To whom then will you liken God, or what likeness will you compare with him? There's verses about the ludicrousy of turning to idols. We'll see more of that in the chapters to come, so I'll leave it. Let's go to verse 21. Don't you know? Haven't you heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he who sits above the vault of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. We think about the mighty people of the world. We think about the scary people of the world. We think about the people who would make us nervous if they showed up and we had to talk to them because they're so powerful. And God says, bugs, just grasshoppers, nothing, less than nothing, meaningless. Who is this God? He stretches out the heavens like a curtain. He spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He it is who reduces rulers to nothing, who makes the judges of the earth meaningless. So the rulers, the judges of the earth, and every other problem that a person of God could experience, personal or impersonal, living or inanimate, Scarcely have they been planted, scarcely have they been sown, scarcely has their stock taken root in the earth, but he merely blows on them, and they wither, and the storm carries them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me, that I should be his equal, says the Holy One? God says, don't you get it? I'm absolutely unique. You got no problems at all, because your problems I can blow away. I will blow away. I will reduce them to meaninglessness in due time. To whom then will you liken me? And to help you get the point, Isaiah says, verse 26, lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars. People have been doing that all along. The sky has always been considered so breathtaking that people can hardly help but look up. So we look up at the stars, and the scriptures say, look up and see who has created those stars. It was after many centuries of looking up that astronomers finally figured out that this great glorious thing that they weren't seeing, the sun, was actually just one more of those things that they were seeing, the stars. It eventually came out, you know, that the sun was actually another flaming ball of burning gas. It's a star. And as astronomy developed and telescopes were improved, it became clear in a sort of depressing way that the sun wasn't even a particularly spectacular star. It was rather run-of-the-mill kind of star. And then it came out that the sun wasn't actually anything like unique. It was part of a great collection of stars that spiral through space. We call it the Milky Way galaxy. And it's not even in the center, it's off to the side. It would take you 24,000 years traveling at the speed of light to get to the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Don't recommend you bother trying. There's not much there that isn't here, but that's how far out we are from the center of the galaxy. And don't get the feeling that we're not going anywhere, because the whole galaxy is rotating, it's spiraling. And we're in the spiral, 24,000 light years out from the center, so we're clipping along at 500,000 miles a second. Hold on to your pew, that's really quite fast. And settle down in your pew, because we're here for a long time. The orbit that we're on will take, one revolution will take 200 million years. You know, you won't even remember this place by the time you get back here. It's just so big, an orbit. And this is our galaxy. And astronomers will tell you that the galaxy is comprised of stars like our sun, some bigger, some smaller, numbering 150 billion, give or take 50 billion. Some astronomers will say with some confidence, there's about 100 billion stars in this galaxy of ours, and others will say, actually it's 200 billion. So we'll let them tough it out, it's about 150 billion, a whole lot of stars in our galaxy. And as astronomy developed and as telescopes improved, people were able to look through telescopes beyond the limits of the galaxy, and they saw way out there in the distance little smudges, which they took to be nebula, which means balls of gas, like unformed stars. A smudge here, smudge there. The more they looked, the more smudges they saw. It was amazing. There's a lot of smudges out there. We got the stars, and then there's smudges. Well, then telescopes improved. They looked again, and they saw that a lot of those nebula were not nebulous at all. They were not nebula at all. They were not clouds of gas. They were other galaxies. Lots of other galaxies with billions and billions of stars in each. And so far, the count goes, 100 billion galaxies visible from the Earth. 100 billion galaxies, each one with billions of stars. Ours just one of the galaxies in the universe. And we're doing a lot of guesswork here. There's 150 billion in ours, give or take 50 billion. And there's billions of galaxies, each with billions of stars. And this is what's up there. By the way, I just learned this week that the Milky Way galaxy is on a collision course with the Andromeda galaxy. They're expected to collide about 2 billion years from now. Astronomers say, don't worry, it's not likely to have much impact on our solar system, which is good. You know, it takes the worry out of the whole thing. But that's what's going on up there. And you think, well, who's in charge? Who's in control? Well, Isaiah has the answer. And we're to take the answer to heart to understand the nature of the God we serve. Lift up your eyes on high, it says. See who has created these stars. He's done more than create them. He's the one who leads forth their host by number. He calls them all by name. Because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one of them is missing. There's maybe 200 billion in the Milky Way. Maybe there's 100 billion. We're not sure. We're, you know, guessing 100 billion either way. God's not guessing. He has a perfect knowledge of each one, he calls them all by name. And our star, the sun, whips through our spiral, the Milky Way, at a speed of 500,000 miles per second, because God's calling it. God's calling it through, and it's going through. And God's calling the Milky Way towards Andromeda, unless he's going to call it off. But don't worry, there's no impact on our solar system. It's absolutely fabulous to try to begin to understand what God understands perfectly. This is our God. And he governs the conduct of these billions of universes, billions of galaxies in this thing we call the universe. So how many problems have you got? And how many significant problems? Have you got a dozen? Got 2 dozen problems? I mean, if you had to list them, how many problems you got? Well, look, you don't have hundreds of billions, right? You've got a few problems, maybe big ones, not as big as the galaxies that God is calling into place and keeping in place without one of them missing. So God is totally able to look after us, his people. And if he says he's a shepherd and he leads us as if we are his lambs, then we ought to trust him to do so because, well, anyone who's able to look after the universe without much sweat is going to be able to look after you or me with our 1 or 2 or 3 dozen problems. This is our God. So what do we do about all of this? He's great in love, he's great in wisdom, he's great in justice, he's entirely unique. What do? He's so great that we must be great in faith. And so the great chapter 40 of Isaiah ends with a call to faith. Verse 27, "Why do you say, O Jacob, and assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God?" I mean, think of the impertinence here. Somebody says, but you can understand how it looks like. Somebody says, well, yeah, fine. So he's leading the billions of galaxies through the universe, but he's ignoring me. The justice due me has escaped his notice. Isaiah rebukes the thought. "Do you not know? Haven't you heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable." His understanding is beyond scrutiny. His understanding can't be scruted. No one can understand how God understands all of this, but God understands everything. Everything about your problem. All 2 dozen problems. Everything. He does not get weary. He does not get tired. He doesn't sleep at the wheel. He doesn't look the other way and, whoops, there goes your life and you didn't get attended to. God wasn't noticing. His understanding is beyond our understanding, but he understands everything. He gives strength. He does give strength to the weary. And to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youths grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men, even vigorous young men, stumble badly, yet those who wait for the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. You've heard me say, if you've been around here at all, any length of time, that the essence of faith is trusting God enough to obey him. And I stand by that. That's true. Our trust in God is displayed in our obedience. So we must live lives of moral excellence. If we're going to live on the heights, we have to live a life of high moral excellence, trusting God enough to obey him. But when all the obeying has happened, when the component parts of our life are brought into submission to the Word of God, and we've done all our obeying, then the essence of faith is no longer just trusting him enough to obey him, but we add an element. It's trusting enough to wait upon him, trusting him enough to keep trusting him. So you go to God with a problem, and the problem isn't solved, but you find you have the strength to cope with the problem. So what do you do next? Well, the right thing to do is to wait on the Lord for the solution. And what would happen if your friends who see you now standing strong in the midst of some pretty significant difficulties because you're finding strength from the Lord, what would happen to your friends if, oh, don't let me give you the creeps, 10 years from now you've got the same problem and they say, where is your God? You've been looking for a solution for 10 years and you say, I'm strengthened by my God. And yeah, it's kind of annoying that the problem hasn't gone away, but God hasn't gone away. And you see, you are, brace yourself, a much better testimony to the greatness of God 10 years from now with the same problem than you would be now. Now, you can argue that you'd be even a greater testimony of the greatness of God if God would resolve the problem. That's true, too. So keep waiting on the Lord. But if God decides to keep you in your circumstances, like that young woman I talked about who stayed in her circumstances till her child was raised by a single mom to the glory of God, that's God's business. And how dare we say, it's not the best way of doing it, God. No, 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 not the best way at all. His understanding is beyond our understanding. His understanding is inscrutable. So the call to the people who mean to make known the greatness of God is to know how great he is and then to live lives that declare his greatness, that show him off to the world around us. Because there are people in the world who don't know anything about God, fail to understand what a great God he is, so fail to apply for the strength and the help that he is so rich and abundantly able to provide. He's a great, great God. So we must be people of great faith, not wavering, but finding in him the strength to continue trusting him and obeying him all the days of our life. Let's pray to this great, great God.